Blog Talk Radio.
I certainly am. I'm with you.
Hey, Sun Guy Nation and Turnbuckle Turmoil fans, welcome to the Turnbuckle Turmoil show here on another Sunday afternoon. Real fast before we jump into things, if you're looking for some wrestling today, you have Blue Collar Wrestling where you can find myself later this evening in Portland, Oregon. And you also have Prime Time Wrestling happening in Paris, Kentucky today featuring Tracy Smothers. So get out there, support your local wrestling if you have some near you. And without any further ado, we would like to bring our guest onto the show right away, one of the all-time greats in professional wrestling. He wrestled for pretty much every territory you can think of during the territorial days of wrestling. Cowboy Scott Casey, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you. I've been sitting at home today waiting for 3 o'clock watching the football like most people do. And it's been a long time since I've been in the ring, but I have a lot of memories and a lot of good things that I wrote about in my book. Hello?
Yes, sir. Now, the book, as fans probably know, if they do not, Scott Casey released his autobiography earlier this year. It is called One Last Ride, The Tale of Cowboy Scott Casey, and you can find that at cowboyscottcasey.com. And since today happens to be your first time with us, for the people that may not know or if they've not gotten the book just yet, can you tell us how you broke into the business of professional wrestling?
Well, I live in Amarillo, Texas, and like a lot of the guys that became famous and whatever, I broke in with the Funks, and Bobby Duncombe and Dick Murdoch, and it was quite an experience breaking in, you know. I watched it when I was a child in a little town called Borger, Texas, up in the north east corner of the state of Texas. I would bug my dad to take me to it. And finally I got in, went to school and went to college and I met Terry and Dory and all these other guys. And Terry asked me one day, he said, do you want to stay in Amarillo? And I said, well, not really. Why? He said, why don't you try wrestling? And I never thought, I was just kind of speechless that he asked me that. But I said, sure, it sounds great. And it's one of these situations like Sputnik Monroe said to me one time. He said, Scott, he said, by the time you finish your career, you will have been like Coca-Cola. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you'll have been everywhere. And boy, was he right. I went around the world 9 times and, all the free countries that you could go to. And it was just education in itself to be able to go to these places and meet the people and be appreciated.
Wonderful trip.
Yeah, wonderful trip.
Your career was ended after a WWF run. You wrote in the book that you discussed your future with Vince McMahon and when he didn't really have plans for you going forward, you decided to step away from the business altogether. When you were making that decision, was it something you had been contemplating up until then, or was this something that you decided once you had that discussion that was how it was going to be?
Well, like we used to say in West Texas, I decided to put myself out to pasture. Vince and I talked, and I told him, I said, you know, I can accept failure when given a chance to fail. I said, but you guys never did. And he promptly said, well, we never really had a spot for you, and we didn't know what you could do. And I thought, that's kind of funny. But anyway, I, instead of burning that bridge behind me, I accepted what he said, and I left the business, as we call it, and went back to Texas, and I went down to Dallas and stayed there for a few months, and then I went down to Houston. I talked to Ivan Puskey, he and I are very good friends, and he had started a school down there, and I went down there, and I helped him train guys, and that was fun. I mean, it just, you just don't realize how much knowledge you have until you've gotten out of the business and you start relating to things and situations and how to talk, walk, and whatever in the business. And it was really a education in itself, to, and being able to pass that on to other people was really nice. I remember I was with Nick Bobby. We trained some guys too. And you know, I picked Nick's brain quite a bit because, I mean, he was beyond great in this business. And he helped me out a lot. Yeah.
Now, as someone that was in your position with the WWF, you had been a main event guy in several territories previously to that, weren't necessarily a main event guy when you got to the WWF. But for yourself and people that were in similar positions, what was the availability of Vince McMahon like? Were you able to have conversations with him directly? Did you have to go through other people to speak to him? Did you have much interaction just in a normal course of a, say, a month or a few months with Vince McMahon?
If you've never been to a television taping, that's the way I look at it, you can't imagine what it's like. And obviously, Vince was there, you know, and I'd say hi, talk to him about the things, but I never pursued him as far as begging for anything. I never did that. I was just always available, and you know, he always, if he saw me, he'd say, hi Scott, how you doing? And I knew that he kind of cared for me when I went, and I went to the Survivor Series in 88 or 89, something like that, and he walked up to me and he said, Scott, he said, could you do me a favor? I said, what's that? He said, would you fill in? Brian Blair couldn't make it. And I thought, great, I'll be able to make a nice payday. And I appreciated that from him. You know, he's a nice guy. I mean, if you get him away from what we did, you know, I mean, he was a nice man, you know. And but he just didn't have a place for me up there, you know. And sure, I worked main events all over the country and all over the world, but I knew that there was nothing there for me as far as WWE. I, like I used to tell people, I said I was just one of the girls in the show.
One of the territories I don't believe you made during your career, which is a territory not a lot of fans discuss these days, but it actually was a place a lot of guys that went on to prominence started, and that is the Vancouver territory ran by Al Tomko. It may not get a lot of the respect and the remembrance that a lot of the promotions did, but it was still pretty important in the history of professional wrestling. When you were actively wrestling, did you come across a lot of the people that had been to Vancouver? Did it get a lot of talk in the dressing rooms as a place to go?
Not really. It was, you know, a smaller territory, and but I did wrestle up there for the WWF, not the WWE, and what a beautiful place. I mean, it just, and Vancouver is just a gorgeous, gorgeous city, you know. And but yeah, there was some of the guys like Matt Bourne. Trying to think of what was his name. Right now the people escape me, but a few guys would say something about it. You know, Billy Jack Haynes and people like that. You know, I mean, but, you know, they didn't really go into a great deal of conversation about the place. But I'd heard of Al Tomko, but I never met him. And like I said, the only time I was ever up there was when I was with the WWF.
And you mentioned Vancouver being a beautiful area, and it is. Most wrestlers, especially when they traveled like you did and they were all over the world, will have a particular favorite venue where they get to wrestle, whether it's the aesthetics of the building or just the way the crowd interacts during the shows or what have you. Did you have a favorite venue where you went during your career?
San Antonio, Texas. I was there for 8-9 years, something like that, and for Southwest Championship Wrestling for Joe Blanchard and his son Tully and me and Wahoo McDaniels and Chavo Guerrero, Manny Fernandez, to name a few of the guys. But I loved it there. I mean, the people were so nice. The food was just out of this world. If you like Mexican food, I love Mexican food. And they had a place there called Paisanos, and it was Italian food. And this guy made the unbelievable food for Italian restaurant. I mean, he was number one. But I lived down there for like 8 or 9 years, and I used to raise quarter horses, and I had 60 acres that I rented from a guy, and we did, I'd rent out stalls for people, and it was fun. You know, I had a friend that lived down there. His name was Red Howard, full-blooded Cherokee Indian, from Atoka, Oklahoma, and he came down there, and I met him, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because he helped me with the horses, taught me how to, I learned how to shoe the horses, I learned how to, as they say, float horses' teeth, which means you file down teeth in the back, because if you don't, they'll starve to death. I don't know how many people know that, but it's true, and we had so many fun stories. I had starting gates down there, and we had races and things like that, and I would have a little rodeos and stuff, you know, in between wrestling. I mean, it was like a full-time job doing that and a full-time job doing wrestling, but that was my favorite place to be.
You also, during your career, were around a fair number of wrestlers who were infamous for ribbing. I'm sure that you either witnessed a fair share of ribs or at least heard about some of the ribs going on. What was the ribbing like during the course of your career?
Let me say that, you know, obviously I haven't been around the wrestlers that are now with the WWE, but when I was wrestling from 70 to 90, they would pay ribs, you know, because you're on the road constantly on the road, and you know, you're away from your family and stuff, and guys didn't play ribs. Johnny Valentine was notorious for them, and Nelson Royal, Les Thatcher, to name a few. But, I mean, these guys, you know, it was fun. You know, you enjoyed having the ribs pulled, and you enjoyed pulling ribs on guys. I remember I used to, there was a guy, Lynn Denton, he went as a mass man, and I can't think of his name, but he had this thing where he had the club foot gimmick, and he would go to the ring with a cane, and being the little, you know, SOB that I was, I would constantly cut off about a quarter of an inch of his cane. And he finally caught on. He said, Scott, he said, I'm going to get you. And I don't know whether he ever did, but it was fun doing it, you know. But ribs were fun back then, you know, the guy, because you rode in cars with the guys. You didn't fly everywhere like you did, they do now. But well, at the end of my career, I did. I mean, I flew all over the world and stuff. But the ribs were fun. I'll just put it that way.
I believe the name you were looking for was the Grappler. That is what Lynn Denton used.
Yes.
Now, of course, in wrestling, as in most major sports, there have been issues with drug abuse. It was a major problem in wrestling for about 10 years, where a lot of wrestlers were dying before the age of 50 on an alarming basis. We lost a lot of people due to either direct drug use or complications from prior drug use. I know in the era of wrestling that you competed in, it was more or less accepted that that was part of the business, and it was pretty prevalent at that point. Did you see a difference in the drug use going from one territory to the next one, or was the drug usage about the same as far as the industry as a whole?
About the same as what the industry of the whole. You know, you never expect someone to die because of drugs, and some of the guys did a lot of it simply because they were on the road. They were bored, you know, and if they weren't drinking or chasing women, they were doing drugs, you know, and that was just it. And you know, there were guys saying, hey, Scott, come on, try this, try that. And I did that, you know, and I said, you can call me square or whatever. I said, but I am just not into it. You know, I'll drink a cold beer with you. And, but outside of that, I just wasn't my thing. And, but there were some guys that you knew that you could see them and look in their eyes and you could tell something, you know, and that always worried me because if I'm in the ring with somebody, I want him to be on, you know, on his up and up and be able to do his thing, you know, but, that was about it in that situation.
Well, we have a game on the show that we like to play called Word Association. I'll throw out the names of some people that you most likely came across in your career, and the first word or two that pops to mind is the answer. Are you willing to do a round of Word Association?
Sure.
All right, here we go. First name, Wahoo McDaniel.
Meanest, toughest, roughest son of a bitch I ever met in my life, and I loved him to death, and I cried like a baby when he died. We had more fun together. I had a condo, and he shared it with me, and it was unbelievable the things that we did. But I mean, let me put it to you this way. He played middle linebacker for the Dallas Texans before they came, the Dallas Cowboys. Then he went to New York and played linebacker for the New York Jets. And he said one time, he said, everybody talks about Joe Namath. He said, but I made that son of a bitch sit outside the shower room till I got through. He said, I had to beat him up. You couldn't hurt the man if you'd hit him with an axe. Honest to God, he was And I just loved him to death.
Mr. Fuji.
One of the all-time great rivers. Hold on for a second. He had a neighbor that lived next to him. His dog kept doing his business in his yard. Well, Fuji told the man, keep the dog out of my yard. He didn't. So Fuji got the dog and served him up in a meal with his neighbor. I thought it was great. He never did tell him. He just sat there and grinned at him. I would not want to mess around with him either. There's a lot of guys that way. You know, you just can't imagine how mean they could possibly be if they wanted to.
Butch Reed.
Butch Reed, I talked to Butch maybe once a month, and I hadn't seen him in years, and we were up in New York doing a autograph session, and we talked, and he looks great still, and like all the rest of us, his hair's got white, and he's a little slower than he used to be, but he's unbelievable athlete in his prime. He played pro ball for Kansas City.
Tully Blanchard.
Oh, yes. Tully, and I wrote this in my book, and I'm sorry if people are listening to this, don't like it, but he had this irritating way of being a prick. I don't know what it was. I think because Tully could have played football in the NFL, but he tore up his lat. And Roger Staubach was teaching him how to play quarterback. And I think maybe that messed him up. But anyway, when he was with us, you know, you wanted to just slap the hell out of him. And then all of a sudden, I see him in New Jersey at one of these. And lo and behold, he's quiet, he's calm, his hair is white like mine, and he became a preacher. And I said, Tully, I'm not believing that. He said, I know, Scott. He said, I know. He said, I was not the nicest person to be around, but God changed all that. And, well, God bless him. You know, I talk to him once in a while, but great athlete, great in the ring.
Kevin Von Erich.
Kevin, like most of the Von Erichs, he stayed with his brothers. They had this camaraderie that, you know, they would talk to us and all that, but they weren't real sociable. But they knew that they couldn't do it without us. So, but he was a nice guy, or he is a nice guy, since he's the only one that's still alive, you know.
Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, good job. She was my manager for months and months there in Dallas. And everybody thought she and I had a thing going, but we never did. We were just friends, good buddies and stuff like that. But her timing was great in the ring. And, you know, she even said things to me that made me think of things in the ring. And she lives in Florida somewhere, and she's married and got kids. And I lived down there for a couple of years and tried to look her up. Never could, but really nice lady.
Gordon Solie.
The golden throw, Gordon Solie. He, unbelievable announcer, quick and to the point, knew everything there was about wrestling, and he was always kind and sociable to me.
referee Eric Mannheimer.
You know, I remember the name, but I can't remember anything about the man, honest to God.
Dynamite Kid.
You talk about a river. The little Brit never let up on anybody. He pulled ribs that I can't tell you about on me. Also on the Rougeos, and one of the Rougeos knocked his teeth out, his front two teeth. And he always thought he was bigger than life and could whip everybody. Well, I got news for you. There was a lot of guys up there could rip you a new one and never think twice about it. And that's why he got his teeth knocked out by, I think, one of the Rougeos.
Gino Hernandez.
Good old Gino. He used to think I wrestled with him, against him, whatever, and he would come across like he was better than everything in the world. I looked at him a few times. I'd say, Gino, you might as well just sit down and shut up. And I said, because I'm not going for any of your BS. And I told him that, you know. I mean, he thought he was greater than God, and he was prettier than everybody, and he didn't. He always was one of the headliners with Houston, which was one of our big, big paydays. And I was always told that Paul Bosch was his father, but it never came out that he was. But I'd heard that through the grapevine, but didn't matter to me because I was born illegitimate too. So, where you go.
Kevin Sullivan.
I saw Kevin about, how long have I been up here, huh? 5 months, 6 months? About 6 or 7 months ago. And in Tampa, they have the Legends, and I went there, and I turned around, and I looked, and there was Kevin. Great, great guy, and he loved to pull ribs and tell funny jokes, and almost didn't recognize him. He shaved his head and had a Fu Manchu. Now I looked at him, I said, you little devil. He said, how are you, Scott? Great guy, hell of a worker, and great. The crowd loved him, or whether they liked him or not, they still love what he did.
Jim Cornette.
There is a wrestling autograph session thing that they do in Charlotte, North Carolina, and it's called The Gathering. And that's the first time I've seen Jim, oh God, 30, 40 years, something like that. And I walked up to him, and he said, and he recognized me right off the bat. A lot of times people don't recognize you when you age. You don't look anything like you did. You don't have the muscles you had. You don't have the dark hair and mustache like you did. But he was just beaming all over to see me again. I said, it's been a long time. He said, yeah, a lot of river has gone under that bridge. And what a talk. What a manager. I mean, he was like Bobby Heenan. He was instantaneous thoughts about anything and everything that you could think of, according to wrestling.
Fabulous Moolah.
Well, Lillian, which is her name, was quite a gal, and she was quite a booker and promoter, and she trained gals, and whisper in my ear one time, if we had time, I'd jump you right here. And I'm now she, at the time, I'm probably in my 30s, and she's in her 60s. But quite a gal she was, and quite a showman, and was taking bumps when she was 60 and 65 years old. I said, I can't believe you still do this. She said, I love the money. So there you go.
Mark Nolte.
Mark was a great, I don't know what you'd call him, gopher or whatever, but I mean, he always was around the office and always did things with the office and had a nice smile on his face. Never was arrogant or mean or anything like that. And I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he was a nice guy.
The final name, Adnan L. Casey.
Hell of a worker, hell of a talker on the mic. And I think I might have worked with him one time. You know, I mean, there's so many guys that I work with. I stop and think about it. I can't remember how many hundreds of guys that I actually worked with. But I named quite a few of them in the book. So, but he was a good worker.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT is standing by, and I know QT has a few questions as well, so I'm going to pass things over to him for a bit.
Okay.
Well, thank you, QT. Hello, Scott.
How are you, QT? What is that, an abbreviation, or what is that?
Yes, QT stands for quite terrific.
Drink to that, then. As long as you're happy with it.
Yeah.
No, I'm doing fine. Yeah. Got a lot of aches and pains. My little dog's barking. And got a lot of aches and pains, but it comes with, you know, I thought some one time I was trying to remember how many years I worked and how many nights. Well, you normally wrestle indoors so you can work year round. I remember one time I worked for 3 years and never had a day off. But anyway, you get all these aches and pains and stuff, and I guess it just comes with the territory.
Well, Scott, can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners what the name of your dog is?
The dog? Cricket.
Yeah, what your dog's
name is. It's a Pomeranian. And he's solid black and crazier than a pet coon.
Oh.
Actually, it's her dog.
Wow, all right. Okay. Well, Scott, I read your autobiography, One Last Ride with Scott Casey, and I was intrigued about the story when Andre the Giant came to your house for Thanksgiving. Can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners about how Andre broke a skateboard?
Well, first of all, it was Thanksgiving, and Andre, I invited him over. He was staying in a hotel, so I went and picked him up. I had a 72 Chevy Blazer, and he could ride in the damn thing. He was damn big. But We went back to the house. I picked up about 2 20-pound turkeys, and me and him and Chris Taylor, who was a wrestler for Iowa State, Gordon, God, I can't even think of Gordon's last name. Anyway, then a couple other guys, and I invited them over. And we had all the fixings, pumpkin pie, chocolate pie, big container of iced tea. And by the time it was all said and done, all these guys were laid out. Turkey has that drug in it, it makes you sleepy, except for Andre. Well, it didn't take long. I lived in a cul-de-sac, and it didn't take long for the kids to find out Andre the Giant's at Scott's house. So we went outside, and this one kid had a skateboard, and he was doing all sorts of tricks on it. And Andre said, "Can I try out your skateboard?" He looked at it and said, "You break it, you got to buy it." Now, here's a guy that's almost, by that time, he was over 400 pounds. Gets on the damn thing, goes about 2 foot, and whoosh, the whole thing breaks apart. So what's he do? He pulls out, I forget if it was $50 or $100 bill, gave it to the kid. Kid was all smiling. "Thanks, mister." It was funny. But don't try to put a giant on a skateboard. It don't work.
Oh, okay. Well, the name of that chemical they put in turkeys is tryptophan. Tryptophan. Yes.
Yeah. I know. Everybody was laid out.
Yes.
Well, okay. If you've ever eaten turkey dinner, which I'm sure you have, you will know that it will make you sleepy real quick.
Oh, I hear that. Yes. Yes. I bet you Andre ate one of the turkeys himself, probably.
Probably. We all ate, real good. But it was fun. It was one of the funnest Thanksgivings I'd ever had.
Oh, okay. Well, now, Scott, your cowboy image that you started in the ring dovetailed into your personal life, and you set up a ranch with horses. Well, in a seminal moment in the Seinfeld sitcom history, George Costanza lied to his bride-to-be, Susan's parents, that he himself had two horses. Their names, George claimed, were Prickly Pete and Snoopy. My question is, did you yourself have any horses named Prickly Pete or Snoopy?
No. My horse's name was Happy, and the other one was Baby Doll. And we had this match where whoever won kept the horses, right? So Bobby Jaggers is riding in on one. I had to teach him how to ride the damn thing. And I'm on Happy, my quarter horse. And we sold out that night also at the Hemisphere Arena. But no, the other two names you talked about, you tell him, no, he's not telling the truth.
Oh, okay. All right. At any time, did you think about naming your horses Billy Jack Haynes or Roddy Piper? Did you ever think about that?
Oh, I know both the guys, but, never did.
Oh, okay.
If somebody said they did, they're lying to you.
Did any of your horses have baby face or heel personalities?
I think both of them were kind of baby face,
Oh,
when
okay.
You raise horses, you don't raise them to be mean, so because there's too much weight on them and they could hurt you. Now, we had a couple horses that were mean, but they weren't in this program.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Okay. Well, Scott, on page 160 of your book, you said you stopped by a bar called Gilly's, which is near Pasadena, and you met the actor, Mickey Gilly, who was in the movie Urban Cowboy, and he let you put him in a headlock. How do you think Mickey would have done if he had wrestled Goldust today or a couple years ago? Mickey Gilly and Goldust.
I don't think he would have got more than one step in the ring with Goldust, I mean, that's I'm trying to think of Dusty Rhodes' son. And Goldust is like 6 foot. He's got to be 6'4", 6'5", something like that. But no, Mickey was not an athlete. He was an entertainer and a performer and a nice guy. And, you know, I cannot find that picture of him and me. I mean, he's standing there with his tongue out like I'm strangling him, but I'm not, you know. But a really nice guy. And had a lot of fun down there. We used to love to go down to Gillies and wrestle there, and some of the guys would try to get on the mechanical bull and do their thing with it. And it was fun.
Wow, the mechanical bull. You know, Gene Wilder, the famous actor, got on a mechanical bull in the movie Stir Crazy. And I point that out.
Yeah, that was a great movie.
In some ways, Gene Wilder reminds me of yourself. You have a slight resemblance. That's what makes my opinion. Okay. Now,
I never thought of that, but I just wish I had his money.
Oh, yes. Gene Wilder's money, yes. Yes. Okay. Well, Scott, on page 69. Oh, Gene Wilder, I think he passed away. I think he passed away, and I think he joined his wife, Gilda Radner, who died of cancer. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about page 69?
Well, on page 69, you said that you worked a match with Lanny Poffo. My question is, at any time did Leapin' Lanny bestow upon you an honorary degree in sports medicine or kinesiology, that's a study of movement, did he bestow an honorary degree to you? The genius.
Oh, I was probably too stupid for that, but anyway, I worked against Lanny in Albuquerque, and he was quite an amateur wrestler. And prior to that, I wrestled his father, Angelo. And Angelo was really, really light with working when you worked with him. And we did a thing where I covered him, and boom, I didn't even feel him touch me. And they wanted him to win. Well, unbeknownst to the people, I won. And but back to Albuquerque, Lanny had held a grudge against me and tied me up like a Christmas bow. But afterwards, he said, "It's all said and done. We're fine, you know. You messed with my dad, we're going to mess with you." And that was it. But, you know, that's just the way it was. I accepted it.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, at any time, did Lanny Poffo bestow upon you the title of Brother Casey, and did he give you a cap and gown?
Oh.
A cap and gown.
No. I don't know where you come up with these ideas, but no.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, now, Scott, on page 146, you talked about one of your favorite restaurants, and indeed, you mentioned Pisano's to Sign Guy earlier in the show. Your favorite item was the salad. My question is Pisano's still in operation in San Antonio?
I've not been back to San Antonio since 89. So I would not know. But I've got y'all's phone number, and if it is, I'll call you and let you know. Maybe you might want to come down there and try it out. It is incredible food.
Wow. I think I would make a road trip, yes. If you called me up and gave me the number, yes. I think I would.
Sure.
Sounds very good. All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, Scott, to your knowledge, did Big Cat Ernie Ladd ever wrestle a man of similar size like Blackjack Mulligan? Both went about 6'9" and 300 pounds. Did you ever see Big Cat Ernie Ladd wrestle Blackjack Mulligan?
Yes, I did. And I wrestled like Ernie Ladd, too. And quite a nice guy. And I saw him the last time, it was years ago at the Cauliflower Alley Club. And I walked up to him, and he went, Scott Casey. And I can't tell you what he said because it wouldn't be right on the air. But anyway, we sat there and talked for a while, and I could tell that he wasn't feeling well. And it wasn't maybe less than a year later that he passed away. But a hell of a nice man. You know, he even played football for the Kansas City Chiefs in that first year that Super Bowl went on. And, of course, there was a lot of guys that played ball that wrestled. But very nice man. I really enjoyed him.
Wow, I didn't know he played with Kansas City that first year. Wow, I didn't know that. All right. Well, Scott, at any time in your wrestling career, did Lord Jonathan Boyd ever threaten to hit you with a boomerang like he did some opponents in Portland Wrestling?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, anything to get his gimmick over. As a matter of fact, I have a picture of me, Tank Patton, and Lord Jonathan Boyd sitting on a couch, and we're laughing and giggling and carrying on like a bunch of kids. But he enjoyed working with me because I never hurt him. A lot of the old timers were that way, you know, don't hurt me, kid, don't hurt me. And I enjoyed working with him and had some tremendous matches. About all I can say about John.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Scott, can you tell us about your matches where ex-heavyweight champion Joe Louis was referee and he never shared any Old Crow Kentucky bourbon with you?
That is true. And, you know, of course, he was before my era, but I knew that, you know, I think he boxed Max Schmeling or something like that and won the heavyweight belt. And, I guess he was probably in the middle stages of Alzheimer. I mean, he would talk, you know, and I'd ask him things, and he'd start talking, and then he'd just kind of fade away, and I'd be going, okay. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that he was older, and I thought, well, maybe his mind's going on him or something. But he was nice, but he'd always say, boy, never call me Scott. He said, boy, go get me a half pint of Old Crow. And I did, and never gave me any and never paid me for getting it either. But, I out of respect to him, I mean, I was assigned the job of babysitting him, making sure he got to the room, making sure he got back to the hotel, things like that. And that's what I did. You know, George Scott was a booker, and he says, take care of him. You know, he's a national treasure. I said, I know. So it was kind of fun knowing that I got to walk around with a national treasure for a while. Yeah.
Wow, yeah, he lost to Max Schmeling in their first fight, and then he beat Max Schmeling the second time around. Yes. A little bit of boxing history there. Yes. All right. Well, Scott, can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners about the time you and Rip Hawk met Willie Nelson in a bar in San Antonio, and Willie ordered a pitcher of margaritas, and Willie asked for your autograph?
Yes. And the reason he asked it is not for himself, his son. His son loved wrestling. And I was obliged to him. I was glad to. I said, the only thing is I'd love to have yours. And he gave it to me. And I do not know. God, I've traveled so much in the last 30, 40 years that I've lost a lot of things that I wish I had now, and that was one of them. And he came in with Annie Irving and Diane Cannon. They were making a movie called Honeysuckle Road. And this girl that Rip picked up ran over and got him and started talking and telling him who we were here. The next thing I know, he's standing behind me and he says, "Scott, how are you?" I said, "Mr. Nelson." He said, "Don't call me Mr." He said, call me Willie." Really, really tremendously nice man. And I was really happy to have that small bit of time with him.
Wow, okay. All right. Willie Nelson. Very good. Well, Scott, to your knowledge, is Don Morocco still a big fan of Pink Floyd minus the LSD?
Probably. Don and I go back so many years. As a matter of fact, there was a song out called "When Will I See You Again?" And I was stopped in El Paso, staying in a hotel, and I walked up to the door, and the next door, here's Don. He was going back to Hawaii, and I was going to California for someplace. But anyway, Don did partake of his chemicals, and but that didn't make him a bad person. He was always smiling and always fun to be around, and I was with him in a match outdoors one time, and unbelievable. His timing was just, you couldn't find a person with better timing than him. And that I appreciated because, you know, when I lived in Charlotte and I met all the greats, and I was fortunate enough to pick their minds and to work with a lot of them, you know, and timing is of the essence in that business, in our business.
Yes, it does help when another wrestler makes you look good. And speaking of wrestlers that make you look good, did Killer Carl Cox ever stop by your ranch to ride your horses? And if so, did he make any of your horses look like the Triple Crown champions, Seattle Slough or Secretariat?
No, the only time I ever worked with Cox was in Amarillo, and we went. This is the God's honest truth. The trips were horrendous. You start out in Amarillo, you go up to Colorado Springs, you go over to Albuquerque, New Mexico, you come down to San Angelo, and then you go back to Amarillo. And you're talking 2,500 to 3,000 miles a week. You know, I remember, who was it? Moose Murawski told me one time, he said, "You're going to make 2,500 to 3,000. I said, "Great." He said, "Miles." And it was brutal, brutal trips. You know, back then, we drove everywhere. And, you know, it was just on and on. It didn't matter whether it was rain, snow, sleet, hail. We were doing it. It was just like a mailman. We were always getting through, you know. But it was quite an experience. But as far as Cox, he never made it down to San Antonio when I had my horse place. And but he was a great guy, a lot of fun to be around. Would tell jokes and act silly, and but he could be tough as nails too. I mean, the man was quite a performer, and I learned a lot from him.
Very good. All right. Well, Scott, when was the last time that Dino Bravo called you George Burns, and can you tell our listeners why he called you George Burns?
Dino, I saw Dino the last time in about 1990, and because I was older than everybody else. Now you gotta think about this. Most of these guys were in their 20s and 30s, and time when Vince gave me my walking papers, I was 42. So. And he used to call me George Burns all the time. You know, what a, he was a fun guy to be around. I think maybe he just got with the wrong crowd, and that's how he got, his final demise came about. But he and I went to the gym one time, and he said, "Let's have a bench pressing contest." Now I'm about 250. He's about 270, and we got on the bench. He said, "You can do 2 1/4. I'll do 250. All right. I did 52 reps. I was a hellacious bench presser. He did with 2 1/4. He did 53 reps with 250. So,
wow.
I mean, he was just massive and strong as a bull. But he and I always got along great. You know, thank God for that, because he could be a mean SOB when he wanted to.
Holy. Yeah, I'm sure he was tested. Yes. All right. Well, Scott, it was great talking with you. And at this time, I'm going to hand it back over to Sign Guy.
Thank you, QT. Well, Mr. QT, we've got just a few minutes left on the show, and I want to give you ample time if there's anything you would like to say to the listeners and plug and promote anything and everything, the book, any upcoming appearances you might have, website, anything at all. Floor is all yours.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Nick Massey, and you know Nick, for him being my partner in crime on the book. And we've done quite well with the book, and I appreciate the fans that wanted to purchase it. And we're going to be up in, Albany, New York. I'm leaving Bigfoot country. I live down in Arkansas in a little town called Junction City, Arkansas. It's right on, if you were to take a rock, you could land it in Louisiana. We're right next to, right above Louisiana. But we just, I don't know. I'm having a senior moment here about something anyway. But we live out in the country, and it's like 10 miles into town just to go get groceries. And but as far as the book goes, I appreciate the people purchasing it, and I hope they enjoy it. And like I say in the book, if you don't care for curse words or awkward situations, you'll enjoy it. I said, because I told it like it was. You know, I didn't put any of the wrestlers under the bus with their wives, and I could have, but I didn't. That wasn't my style. But I just, I'm going to be up in Albany, New York, flying out of Little Rock, Arkansas on the 14th, and I'll be up there for about 10 days. Nick's got a bunch of places that we're going to go to sell books and autographs, and I'll be up there with Hillbilly Jim and Ivan Putski. So, anywho, that's about it, and thank you for having me on your show, and I hope everybody had fun listening to my crazy times.
Well, Cowboy Scott Casey, it was an absolute pleasure having you on here. We appreciate your time very, very much. Best of luck to you on your travels. And fans, if you've not picked up the book yet, head to cowboyscottcasey.com and get a copy. It was an absolutely fantastic book. QT and I both read the book. It's really, really good. I think you'll enjoy it. So get on the website and order that book if you have not already. And if Scott Casey's at an appearance near you, go definitely find him, talk some wrestling, get the book signed. We will be back with you next week. Next Friday afternoon, we have one of my favorite people in independent wrestling, PT Hustler. And 1 week from today, we'll be back with you 2 big hours next week. We have 2 guests coming on. Should be great go support your local wrestling. Find me in Portland today at Blue Collar Wrestling and the North Portland Eagles. And we'll talk to you soon.